tells you what your rights are, and and that you have the right to see an attorney. Hmm. But if you don't I've seen books of workman's compensation laws, and there was no way they could send you a book through the mail to know what's going on. Yeah.
So as soon as you got out of the hospital, you hired counsel then?
Correct.
And was this, a small question, was that before or after the comp department had sent you this book? When did you get the book?
Before. I had a previous injury, mm-hmm. and I had received a booklet before, mm-hmm. so I know what I would receive through the mail. From the injury.
You hired counsel before you got this book for this claim?
Correct.
One more question.
Sure. You'd had a previous claim, so I'm assuming you had you knew what to expect to some extent.
Correct.
And did you hire counsel on your previous claim before this one?
No.
The question I have to ask is, you come out of the hospital and you hired an attorney, and you didn't before. Is there some reason?
I knew that I had a fractured skull and I was deaf in one ear.
I see. You're a little panicky then.
I did not know what to do. That's why I say there is a difference between a minor and a major injury. A minor injury, you don't really need it, but when you have a major injury, you have no choice. You just don't know what to do or what's going to happen.
Thank you.
Mr. Ray Schneider, you said something that interests me. You said you went to the U of O med school with a cut finger. I assume you were losing blood, but
yes.
You know, you just got to tell us how you fractured your skull under the circumstances of receiving care at the U of O.
They stood me at a sink to wash out the finger with with an iodine sponge, and she told me to make sure that the flap of skin was pulled back and that it was bleeding to wash out any dirt. And it was really rather warm that day. It was over 90-95. I got very woozy and passed out, fell over backward, and hit my head on the tile floor. And there was nobody else around.
There was no one else around?
No.
We've been handed out stipulations. Is that a copy for the record? Is that a copy of the settlement in your workers' comp case?
Correct.
Representative Johnson?
I got the impression from your testimony that the reason you hired the attorney in the first place after getting in the hospital was that you felt you had a claim against the hospital, and that was your initial reason for hiring the attorney. Was to deal with that issue.
It was to deal with both of them at the same time, mm-hmm. the workman's compensation and the possible issue of filing suit.
You had not have to pay your own fees for part of that attorney's cost? Didn't you have to pay for part of the cost of the attorney's work or his advice on dealing with your claim, the part you thought you had a claim against the hospital? Did he charge you for that, or did that go all together?
It just went all together due to the fact that he knew about the statute, so he knew there wasn't anything he could do.
Yeah, okay. I won't do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I don't think everybody's going to believe this, but the last person I actually have signed up is, I've heard about a Blazer playoff game tonight, but the last person signed up is Tom Whalen on House Bill 2700.
Okay. Now
we've got some.
I can't believe my good fortune. Let me get the wheel. I'm taking a little bit by surprise. It's all these people here. I thought there was going to be a wheel. Colonel, I'm Tom Whalen, Reagan State Firefighters Council.
As the members of the committee know, we've submitted a bill that would make a harder lung disability in the case of firefighters to be conclusively presumed to have been occupationally related. We've gone through a great deal of testimony from both sides on this, and I believe we've made a case for the need for an improvement in the current language, and I have to concede that the opposition has certainly made a case for the possibility of unwarranted claims in the event a conclusive presumption became law.
This is not what I have here. Okay.
What I'm submitting now in the way of an amendment is to back off from the conclusive presumption. It was my understanding that there is no middle ground between the disputable presumption we currently have and a conclusive presumption which we have proposed. And the proposal you now have, the amendment you now have, would leave it as a disputable presumption, but would require the insurer to deny the claim on the basis of clear and convincing medical evidence that the cause of the condition or impairment is unrelated to the fireman's employment. That would still give the insurer the opportunity to prevail in claims where the, for example, the heart condition was a congenital defect of some kind, a virus that I would assume in nearly all, if not all, instances was unrelated to the fireman's employment. There's no question that a conclusive presumption would bring into that dragnet claims that arguably and convincingly were not occupationally related. Hopefully, this amendment will move us off the center we're on now, where a physician who subscribes to a school of thought that stress and physical and mental stress do not cause heart disabilities will have to go a step farther and point to a cause that could be established as establishing the disease is unrelated to the fireman's employment. That, if we can give that a try and see how it goes, it's a consensus of my people that we'd be willing to live with that.
Is there a definition, as I understand from counsel, there's a legal definition to to the meaning of clear and conclusive, that's what's coming out.
Clear and convincing, I see.
Clear and convincing, okay.
I wish it was clear and conclusive, but often
that was the original form of the bill.
Okay.
Be willing to honor an amendment.
Okay. And at the same time, I had no questions. I didn't want to review this. But in brief, what would you say as counsel that difference would be in current law?
Well, our chair would probably be more informed than I on that score.
Have you had a chance to look that over?
I've seen it, yes. As I understand the standards of law, there are three standards generally used in courts of law. One is by a preponderance of the evidence, which is normally more likely than not, 51%, if you will. Clear and convincing is the next higher standard. And then beyond a reasonable doubt is the highest standard used. So if you want to compare standards of evidence,
those are 20%.
Well, courts will never talk about it in terms of percentage because they're flexible in their language and how they deal with it. But it's higher than by a preponderance, but lower than beyond a reasonable doubt.
Would current statutes be preponderance as the standard then?
In
current standard, preponderance of the evidence would be what would be required.
Well, in this case,
I think that's a question that may need to be addressed because under the existing law, existing heart and respiratory law for firefighters, the presumption we heard about in the other cases has been in much litigation, and the effect of that presumption, and I think the courts in analyzing it somewhat overlook what preponderance means.
It was the impression I had from some information I got from the Salem City Attorney that the case involved indicated a strengthening of the standards in the decision that they had. I don't know if there's some disagreement about that, too.
I read it, and I personally disagree with that conclusion. I think others may differ, though.
Could that be because of your position on being generally on one side of the issue rather than...
Certainly not.
I apologize.
Representative Shipwreck, did you have anything?
I'd just like to know what side of the issue you usually are.
Thank you, Mr. Whalen.
Thank you for your time. It's late.
Jennifer, do we have 2376? Do we have an amendment in our file? I see we have a couple of people.
I'd like to correct that on the record. Mr. Kalinowski remind me that at the committee's last hearing on House Bill 2376, he made the proposal, a conceptual amendment, if you will, to House Bill 2376, which would accomplish two things. One, instead of using 66 2/3% of wages at time of injury as the amount of pension, he would substitute 80% of take-home pay.
Or spendable.
Or spendable income is another way to express it. The amendments technically actually set out what deductions are to be taken out of the paycheck. Mr. Kalinowski is looking at me like I'm about to not describe this correctly.
That's why
and he'd rather do it himself.
Mr. Kalinowski, will you please sign in?
Thank you,
I'm Jack Kalinowski from the Associated General Contractors. Mr. Chairman, let me be perfectly clear. The conceptual amendments we proposed were twofold. For lost time benefits, that the benefits be based on 80% of the historical net wage that the employee has earned over computed in the same manner that unemployment compensation benefits are computed right now, and for permanent total disability. The reason I corrected you, Jennifer, is because you used the word pension, and it's lost time benefits that we're talking about, where we're talking about the history of spendable income. And for permanent total disability benefits, our conceptual amendment would say that the Social Security retirement benefits would be offset from the permanent total disability entitlement from workers' compensation in the same manner right now that Social Security disability benefits are offset from the permanent total disability benefits that accrue to a worker.
Mr. Kalinowski, are you having those, are you going to present those at our next meeting?
They have been drafted. And they're in the possession of Representative Leek now.
May I ask a question concerning the latter? Does the Social Security system allow for offset against its benefits for workers' compensation received?
They do, unless the state legislature says exactly the opposite, and in 1977 the Oregon legislature did say just that. Prior to that time, Social Security disability benefits were not paid to an injured worker if his workers' compensation benefits exceeded the Social Security disability entitlement. Under the present system in Oregon, the injured worker receives his full Social Security disability entitlement, and then the workers' compensation carrier pays whatever is added to that, if anything is added to that.
So that effectively then transfers, under our existing system, it transfers the cost, of some costs of Social Security. No, it puts additional costs on Social Security and puts less cost on the workers' compensation carrier. What you're describing, isn't it?
I think it had that effect. I think the effect was extremely minimal on the Social Security system in the United States. But that system
we've heard about lately a bit.
Have we talked about the cost of workers' compensation in Oregon?
Well, I think we have. But, yeah, we're,
yes.
You'll have those amendments Monday.
Can I follow?
Yes.
Jennifer?
You described federal Social Security disability benefits.
Yes.
What happens when the disabled worker who is receiving federal Social Security disability turns 65? Does he or she continue to receive disability, or is it now retirement? And is that what your bill, is that the target of your bill, that turning of 60 to 65?
Currently, the injured worker would continue to receive the same exact money from Social Security. But Social Security says now it's a retirement benefit. Exact same dollars and pennies.
Really?
But now they say it comes out of the retirement pot instead of the disability pot. And in addition, the injured worker would receive his full workers' compensation entitlement. Let me try to draw and probably oversimplified picture. Let's assume that the worker is injured, becomes permanently and totally disabled before age 65. Under the current system, and his workers' compensation entitlement is $600 a month, and his Social Security disability entitlement is $400 a month. He would receive a total of $600 a month. $400 from Social Security, $200 from the workers' compensation insurer. At age 65, he begins receiving $1,000, $400 from Social Security, and $600 from a workers' compensation insurer.
Mr. Kalinowski, I'd appreciate it if you would get us the applicable federal regulations when you present your and law on Social Security offset when you present those amendments. I'd like to see them.
I'll try.
Representative Johnson.
In the interest of time, it would be good if we could get some of the fiscal information with regard to your lost time issue and the so-called spendable wage and the historical aspects. If that can be accumulated where we have some of the fiscal information and fiscal studies that might have been done on that, so that it'll, in the interest of trying to make a decision, maybe we could move more rapidly.
I'm not sure that there is any applicable fiscal information, nor am I sure there's any applicable Social Security regulations. Well, but you see, Representative Johnson, the fiscal information was based upon a maximum of 100%, a maximum benefit of 100% of the average weekly wage. And I don't think there is any fiscal information that is available if the maximum benefit goes to 200% of the average weekly wage with the Social Security retirement.
Maybe we can ask your counsel to see if some of our agency people can come up with something to deal with this once you are ascertained what his formula is exactly to be.
A fiscal statement for his amendment?
Yeah. I mean, some kind of a picture, either an example type thing or something that says a contrast of what would happen under this versus another reasonable example, or if we can get a broad brush picture of what that will represent, even some expert estimates.
I think also in that, and I directed it to you, I directed it to Jennifer too, if we could have some examples of the effect on the individual workers involved in the system of such an amendment.
I think,
and also, if I may, and also the federal Social Security law and regulations concerning offset, too.
Yeah.
That's not only directed to you, but
I'd like that to Jennifer, too.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we can very adequately draw a graphic picture of what would happen in these instances. I'm not sure that we can do all the things that you're asking for, but we will try. One other thought occurred to me, however, before I leave the witness chair that I think is important. We're not suggesting that the permanent total disability benefits be tied to historical wage earnings. I want you to understand that.
Okay.
Only the lost time benefits.
Only lost time. That's what I understood you had in that. But,
Do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. What's the thinking behind distinguishing those two situations?
Well, at least in my estimation, if a person has suffered a disabling injury and loses time, you would normally expect that worker to return to work sometime. And he has little, if any, normally lost capacity to earn a living. However, if that employee is permanently and totally disabled, he or she has lost all of their wage earning capacity.
Aren't TTDs sometimes on time loss for years, though? Isn't that possible before they become stable?
Occasionally, probably. Rarely. The most serious. Mm-hmm. The most serious are.
Thank you.
But not normally.
Thank you. Representative Shubrack, anything? Thank you. John Powell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, I'm John Powell, representing the Oregon Workers' Compensation Federation. I want to thank you for calling Mr. Kalinowski just before me, because I always like to look good, and it's easier. I'm sorry I wasn't signed up. My boy's tricycle got run over, and
No,
he wouldn't believe that his mother did not do it intentionally, so we had to replace it this evening. I just wanted to comment very briefly on House Bill 2378 and House Bill 2473. I represent private carriers of workers' compensation. As you know, the workers' compensation market is very competitive at this time. In fact, private carriers are leading the charge and are, in fact, have some of the lowest filings on record. And we will continue to do so. However, I think the subcommittee, when it comes to benefits, has to weigh in the public policy question as to what will happen to those rates if some of the legislation passes. Primarily, if you look at House Bill 2378 of adding the attorney's fees on top of the award, it deals with the policy question that other witnesses have brought to you, that is the theory of the private attorney general. In fact, we're in a position of being penalized for upholding a state agency's decision. But beyond that, I think the fiscal impact is estimated at between $5 and $7 million if there is no additional litigation. We're convinced there will be additional litigation, and this is simply will add $5 to $10 million to the cost of the system, and we think you should keep that foremost in your mind in making that decision. Secondly, on House Bill 2473, this provides the exemption from the liability limitation of workers' compensation when an employer knowingly removes a safety device. The way subsection 3 on the first page on line 20 is worded, and then the new language that follows, we're convinced that an insurer could be held liable for this act of an employer. That is, the insuring company may well be paying benefits due to the intentional act of an employer. That, in essence, violates a very basic principle of insurance, and that is not insuring against intentional acts. And I think the committee should look at that very carefully before submitting House Bill 2473 to the full committee.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Shipwright.
You made an important point there, John. Could you back up? Let me get this straight. The insurance carrier would be insuring one against the obvious injury.
Yes.
And then you lost me. And well, then that they would...
In fact, the exemption here reads that the exemption from liability given to an employer under this section is also extended to the employer's insurer. Okay. Then if you turn except, this exemption shall not apply, including the exemption to the insurer, where the injury is proximately caused by the employer knowingly removing from any machine, etc., this device.
Okay.
So, in essence, the worker could then sue the insurer.
Okay, I thought that's what you meant.
Let me follow up on that, John. If the 2473 were amended to allow an employee under these factual circumstances to sue the employer under the normal third-party arrangement under comp, where comp insurer would be reimbursed from the proceeds of such a sale, could it not lower the workers' compensation rates? I'm not sure if you follow me.
Yeah, I follow you, but I'm not sure.
Under third-party recovery, the workers' comp insurer would be entitled to reimbursement from proceeds, and if they weren't enough, under a formula, but if mm-hmm. they were enough, to full reimbursement.
Yes.
Isn't it possible, then, that the enactment of 2473 with the normal third-party type liability provisions could lower actual insurance rates in workers' comp?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that there would be... I'm just not sure in that case whether there would be... I would just have to look at the facts and see, but I'm not prepared to answer that.
I have another question.
Representative Shipwright.
John, going back to what we just discussed, and this may seem like a simplistic question, and I hate them, but isn't the reason for insurance to cover an employer that may be sued?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shipwright, one of the basic premises of the Oregon workers' compensation system is, in essence, giving up mm-hmm. that right to sue. And again, that's one of the things that makes us uneasy about this step, is that we, again, think it's a step backward. We think that the safety laws and enforcement of those laws should be enhanced as opposed to going this direction. We think that this will probably not be the kind of incentive that it's meant to be, and that we'd be better off to provide a program of safety inspection that has teeth in it, which knocks on the door more often, has stiffer penalties perhaps, but going that direction as opposed to taking this, what we consider a step backward with the law in this regard.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I've just served on a subcommittee relating to boilers, and the insurance industry is very active in the inspection
yes.
and obviously underwriting the insurance on boilers, and they actually have field inspectors. Is there any relation? Does this happen in workers' comp? Are there insurance companies that will go into their insured's workplaces?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shipwreck, yes. And in fact, that's a growing part of workers' compensation coverage is safety inspection and risk management.
Now, they have a vested interest in
it. Yes, they do. And in fact, that's, I think, one of those services that many of our companies offer employers that attracts them to their coverages. In fact, those very kinds of services, those safety inspections and monitoring and they'll actually go out and do a survey and a list of improvements to be made for safety, and that's an ongoing process.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Mr. Powell, we've had some testimony before on this bill that the effect of such bill, such law, may well be a safety inspector self-enforcing mechanism without having the safety inspector come around. That is the potential of such a claim would be self-enforcing and conducive to a safer workplace, at least in this particular instance. Do you have any comment on that?
I do, Mr. Chairman. I believe in a limited number of cases it would provide exactly that kind of an incentive. However, it's been my experience in the area of workers' compensation that most employers, particularly at the supervising level, do not know the workers' comp law. They do not know that that liability actually exists. And when we start relying upon their understanding of the workers' compensation law to provide safety, I think it's a step back.
My point is, if you settled out of court, the chances are that a lot of these would be settled out of court. And you're right, it could go either way. I don't know. In certain instances, maybe it would. In others, maybe they'd fight it in court.
Well, I guess one of my problems is, philosophically, Mr. Representative, is we have a system that during appeal, when a request for hearing is filed, the case goes to hearing, testimony is presented, and the first layer of appeal is that decided by a referee.
Mm-hmm.
If a referee decides a case in favor of the claimant, our statutes require that the employer pay those benefits pending appeal, regardless of what happens to it up above.
Mm-hmm.
So the employer may win, and there are cases that I'm sure that this committee has heard, mm-hmm, where the employer has paid out. One case in particular, I think it was the RIF case, RYF, some years ago, where the employer paid out $76,000 till the case was finally reversed by the Court of Appeals. But regardless of that, you're not, I guess what I'm addressing myself to is the contingency of the situation. A claimant may gamble and go to hearing, but the claimant still has no gamble here. Under our system, the claimant doesn't have to pay any fees out of his pocket. He pays contingent upon an increase in the award, or if it's a denied case, the employer pays the fee anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I'm concerned, that's a tremendous benefit to a claimant.
Well, that's current law.
That's current law.
Yeah, that's what we're not talking about.
Well, I'm not saying to remove it at this time, because we're only addressing ourselves to whether we should add another layer to that and add incentive to file cases in small situations. We just feel that the cost is such that it feeds the disincentive in the system.
Another question, Mr. Chairman.
If I might just ask a question, Mr. Lutke came in here and testified that the way the bill was worded, in his opinion, that it would allow for fees, add-on fees equivalent, at least with existing rules and regulations, to 8% of the increase. Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure I understand. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Lutke,
can you give an example?
Who you referred to earlier testified that at least the way the bill is worded, that the add-on fees under existing board regulations and with the wording in the bill would be equivalent to the contingency amount of 25%?
I'm not sure that it would. I can't answer you directly. I don't. That would not.
So you don't have an opinion like Mr. Lutke did?
I guess I don't understand what you're trying to tell me that he said. I don't recall that. Is there? Can we take an example?
Well, let me back up for a second and ask you a question about something you said earlier. If there were a settlement of $700, there might be a fee of $300 in the present system. Did I understand you correctly?
Under the present system, with a settlement of, with an increase in the award of $700, the fee is 25% of that.
Maybe then I misunderstood you on what you were talking about.
I was trying to extrapolate it into this new system. And really what I was talking about is that the entire award may only be worth another $200 in order to bring the scheduled injury up to 100%. But yet the employer could be forced to pay economically more than the finger would ever be worth, in order to avoid having to go to hearing and paying perhaps an additional $1,000 to the attorney for the claimant, and perhaps something in that nature to its own attorney.
I see. Well, then you've just answered my question by saying under those circumstances there could be a $1,000 fee, and that was not the way Mr. Lutke testified.
I don't recall how he testified. I don't choose to be inconsistent with him, but I just don't. I may not be tracking with you on that.
Representative Johnson,
it just does seem to me that what we need to look at is trying to establish a system that doesn't require attorneys to process. I don't know if that would please you or not, but that would be my goal.
My goal, too, as long as it remains becomes a fair and equitable system of just compensation.
I think there are arbitration procedures that would be very adequate.
And there may be in the smaller cases which may address this situation. But we feel that we're not about to say that the claimant should not have his day in court, his or her day in court.
Yeah, I think there should be a final appeal process for clear use of awards or something like that, but I am convinced that it's possible to at least take care of well over half the cases without ever having to have an attorney deal with them. Those that would be appealed today.
And I think the Workers' Compensation Board is trying to address that at this point.
Yeah.
Shall we get to Mr. Hart? Mm-hmm. Mr. Hart.
My name is Dick Hart. I represent the Oregon Self-Insurers Association. I'd like to make some brief comments on a couple of different bills, and being unable to come to Salem as frequently as I would like, I'm not sure if testimony has been given on some of these by our association. But let me just start. House Bill 2376, which would raise the temporary and permanent total disability benefits to 200% of the average weekly wage. Our association, which by the way represents, we have approximately 175 member companies in the state of Oregon, which are our self-insured companies. Our association agrees with the amendments that have been offered by Associated General Contractors that we can go along with the increase to 200% of the average weekly wage if there is corresponding consideration for historical wage base and 80% of take-home pay.
Maybe I could ask, do you know of any information or documentation that could be provided that deal with that issue, studies or otherwise?
No, I'm really not.
Okay.
On the issue of the House Bill 2473, the safety devices, I'm convinced, and this is based on past experience in industrial safety, that this would generate a tremendous amount of litigation, besides being a step back away from the no-fault workers' compensation system, the historical compromise. It would be a jam up in the courts, I think. It sounds very reasonable that if an employer intentionally removes a guard from a machine which causes an injury, that he should be liable. The problem is in the practical application of this, and any of you who have been involved in industrial safety know that very competent, experienced, skilled safety inspectors do not see the same thing. A safety inspector, and we've experienced this in our plants, it happens all the time, will come in from the accident prevention division, for example, and make a certain list of safety violations. Another safety inspector from OSHA, who was monitoring or was in the past, would come in and maybe luckily or by coincidence catch a few of the same items, but come up with a different list. An inspector from an insurance company, yet a different list. And what I'm saying here is that a safety device, whether it is required, whether it is within the safety regulations of the state, or whether it is not, is a very subjective matter. And I can see a situation occurring where every accident would bring a suit because of some alleged violation of some safety regulation. And it just looks like a can of worms to me.
Questions? Representative Hammond, may I just, I listened to the question asked by Representative Shipwreck, and I wanted to just add one thought that maybe isn't clear. The question came up about filing the appeal and whether the attorney fees, you know, whether the companies are going to settle. And I think that based on the bill that's being presently presented, if an insurance company wants to settle the case with the injured worker, the attorney fees under those circumstances are going to have to be paid in addition to compensation, even though the matter does not go to a hearing, does not go before a hearing referee in the litigation. The reason for that is that the provision allows that in all other cases in which attorney fees are awarded, they are to be paid in addition to the claimant's award of compensation. Under the present circumstance, to settle a case, the attorney fees have to be approved by the Workers' Compensation Board, and that's the reason that stipulations are prepared, providing for the attorney fees in one paragraph of that stipulation and then sent to a hearing referee to approve. It's both to approve the award that's being allowed as being reasonable, and it's also to allow the attorney fees. I think that as Dennis Bebrowski has pointed out, one of the problems that would occur in this situation is that it would become more difficult for the insurance carriers to settle the cases in lieu of going to hearing. And in fact, many cases, and I've not also been privy to all the testimony, I'm sure you've heard much regarding this as well as the other bills, but the situation can occur and does occur where insurance carriers even today prefer to settle the cases with the claimant in lieu of going to any kind of litigation for innumerable reasons, one of which is they don't want to hire their own lawyers and would prefer to settle the cases rather than have litigation. The difficulty that I see with the present bill is that the award that's allowed is allowed by the evaluation division, over which the carriers have no input in the sense that they send the medical reports there and the award is calculated. And I'm sure you've heard testimony about carrier claim closure, and I'm not here to suggest that's what should occur. But it seems a difficult situation for a carrier to be presented with an award that they then have to defend with the a liability, the attendant liability, that if they don't defend that award, then they have to pay the attorney fees in addition to the compensation. They can't, even if they were to conclude that the claimant's award was inadequate, even under these circumstances, they can't settle the case without paying the attorney fees in addition to compensation. I think Mr. Schneider, who earlier comments were given here, indicated that he had hired his lawyer before
his claim had ever gone to the evaluation division. And so if that award had come down, Mr. Schneider being represented by counsel at the time, even if the carrier had felt the award to be inadequate, could not have settled with Mr. Schneider, except through his attorney, to the extent that he was represented by an attorney, without paying an attorney fee in addition to compensation. So it seems, or it would appear to be, a circumstance in which it would defeat at least part of the basis, at least, which this provision has been suggested to be passed, which is that it would reduce litigation. I think I would agree with Dennis in that regard. I don't see that it would reduce litigation and would just be an add-on expense to a system that we already have. I don't know. I just wanted to add that as my thoughts and comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dangerous question, but we don't have anybody else signed up. Is there anyone else that wishes to say anything tonight?
Could I make one comment?
It's on
a bill that hasn't even been addressed here today. That's the surviving spouse benefits. And it's something that, again, the Oregon Self-Insurers Association can support an increase from 50% of the average weekly wage to two-thirds with some corresponding amendments. And specifically, the situation now exists under the Oregon law that when a couple is living in a common law situation and one of them is killed in an industrial accident, the survivor does receive workers' compensation benefits. That seems fair, as it should be. The injured worker was supporting the survivor, and so the system should support them. However, take the same situation down the road. The survivor who is receiving surviving benefits several years later decides to live again in a common law situation with another individual, you would think that that would stop the benefits, but it doesn't. It seems somehow inconsistent. And what is happening in Oregon is that surviving spouses do not remarry. They, quite frankly, move in with somebody and live as though married, but they do not remarry, and that keeps the benefits coming. And I think that's an abuse of the system that should be corrected.
Thank you. One additional thing for the members. I've had some inquiries on potential other benefits bills, and I'd ask whether there'd be any objection if this subcommittee would report back and request that should the main committee wish to refer any further bills, that we be an ongoing committee. Is there any objection to that?
I might need. I just didn't go in one place and really consider it all at once. It's not hard to decide.
We are. Nothing further. We're adjourned.
Oh, got a man.
I wanted to suggest a bill that you might more or less touch on the subject slightly. I think it's 2511, the payment pending appeal, if you'll recall. You had one hearing on it, then it disappeared. I'd like to bring it back.
I'd like to talk to you about that.
Thank you.
I have some information for you. Hold on, can I make one announcement here?
Oh, sure.
Mr. Dick Goss did give the committee amendments for 2376, and he left. Oh,
no, he's
there.
Right there.
Yeah. You were gone for a while, weren't you?
I was next door.
Well, I'd like to at least make them available.
Okay.
They are related to 80% of spendable wage. Without, I think, the rest of Mr. Kalinowski's refinements. Have you seen them?
I just morality,
That's, no,
I don't really want to get into that.
What'd you say, Steve?